This is the Fucking Normal Podcast, the cheers, tears, and Friday night beers of parenting disabled children.
I'm Rena.
And I'm Lauren.
And we're both mothers to daughters with special needs. Parenting a disabled child can often feel difficult to navigate. If this is you, you're not alone. We're here to share unique parenting stories and chat about the things that we've learnt and are still learning.
Prepare to sometimes laugh, sometimes cry, but hopefully leave with a shot of optimism in your arm. And don't forget, we are talking from a parent's perspective. We would never presume to talk on behalf of a disabled child or adult. So expect bad language and, quite frankly, some brutal honesty.
Because really, what the fuck is normal anyway?
Wake me up, loud as clouds, all my love for you.
Hi, and welcome to another episode of the Fucking Normal Podcast. I'm your host, Rena.
And I'm Lauren.
And today we have a super interesting conversation with three, yes, three guests tackling the topic of bridging the gap, the concept of where we are with neurodiversity and where we would all like it to be. As most of you listeners know, Lauren and I were catapulted into the neurodiverse universe when our daughters were born. We both came in with very little understanding and honestly, very little experience of this world. We both came in with a whole load of neurotypical expectations embedded in our psyche. But throughout the last 6-7 years, we've both come a long way in our understanding and deep appreciation of neurodiversity in all of its wonderful richness. But of course, it goes without saying, we are still learning each and every day, learning how our children see the world, learning how we can best support them in a world that, let's be real, isn't really made for them. And of course, learning what we can do to make it more diverse and embracing for everyone. Before we get into this riveting conversation, it's worth defining some terms we're going to be using throughout. So neurodiversity is a variation in the human experience of the world. People experience and interact with the world around them in many different ways, and there is no wrong or right way of thinking, learning, or behaving. Autism, or ASE, is a super broad range of conditions characterized by social and communication differences, repetitive behaviors, reliance on rules and routines, and increased sensitivity to sensory stimuli. Obsessive compulsive disorder, or OCD, is a condition characterized by recurring thoughts and repetitive behaviors that you cannot control.
And as Rena mentioned, we have three guests joining us to talk about this topic. Firstly, sisters Sophie and Emma Jackson. Sophie is an actor and writer whose debut show, Just Be Normal, explores the topics of autism and neurodiversity. She stars in the play alongside her sister Emma, and it is inspired by their own lives and personal stories. Written off as a problem child, the play explores how Emma, the older of the two sisters, seeks to understand her autism better as she comes to terms with the fact that even those closest to her are poorly equipped to help her on her journey. Meanwhile, Sophie secretly struggles with her own unidentified neurodivergence, which is reflective of Sophie's quite recent real-life discovery that she's been living with OCD. And we'll also be talking to creative director Connor Pierce. Connor's production company, Akimbo, is behind the play, and as its director, he brings his own lived experience with OCD and neurodiversity. He is passionate about making more inclusive and accessible creative spaces, about making inclusion and diversity at the centre of such productions, rather than a tick box afterthought. Welcome to the podcast, Emma, Sophie and Connor.
Welcome.
Hello.
Great to have all three of you here. I'd really like to start with more on Emma and Sophie's personal story and the inspiration for Just Be Normal, the play that we'll talk about in a little bit. So can you tell us a bit more about who you both are, your childhood, and your discovery around your own neurodivergence?
So I'm Emma. I'm the autistic one.
How did you come to realise that you were autistic?
Maybe one of the reasons why I wasn't diagnosed quite early, because I was diagnosed when I was almost 18. But I think one of the reasons why it was missed maybe was because we were moving around a lot. That's why people assumed maybe I was not having, like I was struggling with friends and socially. So I kind of think that part of part of our lives almost masked like certain aspects of what should have been picked up as me being autistic. But yeah, we've always been really close. We've always kind of been at the same school.
How many years difference are there?
So is there 20 months between us?
Oh wow.
So yeah, so we are really close in age. So technically 2 school years, but yeah, less than that. I don't even know. I just crawled through life basically up until I got to secondary school. And there was probably quite a few things in primary. Like, for example, I wasn't making friends. I was very interested in reading. And I was probably quite ahead of age group when it came to reading and like being obsessed with books. I had lots of different obsessions when I was younger. But again, it's kind of like, I think that can be quite a neurotypical or a normal thing to have when you're young. You know, you've got that thing that you fixate on that's really fun for a bit, and then you get bored and it's on to the next thing. So I think it is difficult to pick up on the things that were going on, especially in women and in girls, because it doesn't, you know, portray itself the same way as in men. So anyway, when I got to secondary school, I think that's when my problems started to amp up. I started to find school very difficult. I was very badly bullied. I had basically no friends. And I, through that, unfortunately fell into some quite dangerous people who were living in the area of London I was living in, which resulted in a lot of issues that I now, I have even now, a lot of trauma. But I think it's important to mention, because it's directly related to my autism. I basically fell into a gang, and through that, I got in trouble with the police regularly. My parents were very worried about what my life is going to look like going forward. And that's how I was then referred to a specialist via the police. So that's how the start of my diagnosis happened. But even from that point, it took from, I think I was referred to specialist at about 14. So from then until 18, that's how long it took to actually just get a diagnosis.
So it was your mental health struggles that initiated a diagnosis for the autism.
I want to be careful, because you don't, well, in this country anyway, you don't go to therapy to get a cure from autism. Like that's mm-hmm. I should say that wasn't, obviously at the time I didn't know that I had autism, but yeah. So I got referred to this person because I was very, very depressed, very low moods. I mean, I struggled badly, and without going into too much detail, people were very concerned about my life. And you know, I think I was actually also quite concerned that potentially something would happen or whatever. So yeah, I was referred initially as someone who had quite severe mental health issues, and I was very, very heavily medicated for all of them. But I think that actually quite a lot of what initially appeared as a mental health issue wasn't at all, and was actually just projections of autism. So yeah.
Mm-hmm. It really speaks to, I guess, everyone's lack of understanding.
Yeah,
about behaviors or things that you were perhaps displaying that didn't fit into their neat bracket of what they knew.
Yeah, definitely.
So when did the actual autism through that you got the autism diagnosis?
Mm-hmm.
Right, so when that happened, what was your kind of reaction to that, and what did autism mean to you prior to the diagnosis and at that point?
So it's pretty embarrassing, really, because previously when I thought of autism, me and Sophie knew this boy who was, I think, a similar age to us growing up, who was autistic, and he went to a specialised school that could help him. He was nonverbal, and I think that is what I assumed autism looked like. I never bothered to research it because I was never... faced with it, I guess. And I think when someone mentions like autism as a disability, I kind of thought, well, I'm not a disabled person, which just comes from ignorance and not just, I guess it's like, if it doesn't bother you, why would I research it? Why would have I looked into it? Which is kind of where the issues with all disabilities sort of start, I think. The therapist was like, I'd like you to be assessed for autism. So I went home with that while she did the assessment stuff. So I kind of thought, like, no, surely not, like, whatever. I researched it a bit, but I was kind of skimming. I kind of thought, oh god, another thing that they're gonna slap on me, like, what medication will be they, you know, what they give me this time. I actually also was in the process of being admitted to a psychiatric unit, and through that they also wanted me to be assessed for it, and I think that was actually just a tick box so that they could cover their back. So I think it was that if it came out later that I was autistic and they medicated me for all of this stuff, I couldn't turn around and be like, well, hold on a minute. So that was my assumption. I remember sitting in the car with Sophie and my dad. I don't know if you remember this. I remember, like, us all discussing it, and both Sophie and my dad were like, no, don't worry, like, it's not something that you'll have, they're just doing it to make sure. Then of course I went for the assessment, which is a whole other thing in itself. It's a very odd, like, thing to do, especially when you're at, like, almost 18, because you're technically an adult but the assessment is for a child essentially, so it's a bit odd. Yeah, I remember walking away and thinking, like, I could just tell by the guy who did the assessment that he knew I was ticking all these boxes.
Oh, gosh.
So it was like I was there being like, god, okay, fine. And then when the report came, and it was like a smack around the face a little bit, and it was like, god. Initially I went into like a deep in true autistic fashion. Like a deep dive into everything autism. I looked into savantism. I looked into everything. I was, I think, in a way, trying to relate desperately to people. Even then, so that I didn't feel so alone, because I did feel really alone and a bit embarrassed. And then I think I just went through a grieving process, actually. And then fast forward, I kind of learned to accept it. And, you know, there's, you know, lots of different things that I felt that were really positive. So it was a process. It took a while, basically. But yeah.
It sounds very similar to, I guess, most parents' processes that they would go through. So, yeah. You know, often children are diagnosed very young, and it's the parents that then perhaps go through that exploration, that, like, confusion, denial, grief, acceptance kind of cycle. And yeah, we've heard a lot of parents talk about that. So it's kind of interesting, the parallels, but obviously it was happening. It's you, it's your life, and it's your identity, and it's who you are, but you're only just sort of really discovering a version of yourself at that age, or that there's something specifically neurodivergent in your identity. Almost adulthood. Yeah, it's really interesting. How was that period for you, Sophie?
Let me start by saying that me and Emma have always been able somehow to maintain our relationship, which, like, we've been through, like, a lot together, and we've gone through our phases of not talking, but, like, overall we've always been, like, best friends. So luckily it's not had a detrimental effect on our relationship. But it was really, really difficult growing up with Emma as a sister, because I fell into this place of, like, expectation of I was always fine, I was always okay, I would always get on with it, I would always get up and go to school. And then I always have issues with anxiety, but it's not something that I don't ever really remember having, like, a conversation with my parents about it, being like, oh, I think there's something weird going on with me, like, da 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 da. I think I just wanted to be, I think I wanted to fall into their expectation of being the easy child.
So you
and I
hid
think
it.
That's quite a normal dynamic. Mm. Yeah. So I just kind of, like, got on with it, went to school, blah, 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 until I randomly got an autoimmune disease when I was 16 that I've always had, but it just, like, developed when I was 16. So yeah, I got an autoimmune disease, and then that kind of spiraled my OCD in, like, a health related OCD. way, because I thought I had AIDS, and there was no way I had AIDS, but I convinced myself that I had AIDS, and it was awful, it was terrible, and, like, no one, and I felt like such an idiot, because no one, I couldn't tell anyone that, like, I'm convincing myself that I have all these, because I was like, people are going to think that I'm just seeking attention, people are going to think that I'm just doing this and that. And it got to the point where I really couldn't rationalize anything, like, at all. and it physically affected me. I got this thing called vaginismus, which, because I was so scared of getting sexual health related stuff, my vagina closed and like couldn't get a tampon in, couldn't get anything in, nothing. Oh my goodness. It was awful. So it manifested really physically, and it's like in my body, and then like got a diagnosis and stuff like that. But it was something that I was really embarrassed, and I was really like secretive about it. I didn't really it's something that I've only started talking about in the past 3 or 4 years, and now looking back, I've sort of finally then went to the GP. My parents are like, yeah, like we should have maybe sort of picked up on some signs from when you were really small.
So you were doing it purposefully to make yourself be the more normal child?
Yeah, I wanted to be normal. I wanted to be the normal one. I really did, because I saw the strain that what Emma was going through was causing. No one was really looking at what I was doing anyway. They didn't have to worry about me. So I didn't. It just wasn't a conversation. Like, there wasn't really ever really a conversation about my mental health until afterwards, which is okay. It's fine. Like, it was difficult, but it's okay now.
So did it ease then when Emma got her diagnosis? They were like, right, we know what's happening with Emma. How are you? Kind of thing.
It's difficult, because when Emma was diagnosed, Emma was 18 and I was 16, and Emma had moved out the house.
I'm sorry, I moved out at 16.
Emma moved out at 16. So then I don't know what happened. I just didn't really speak to my parents about it until I was like 18, because it only manifested physically when I was about 17, 18. And then I started going to the doctors, and I then started talking to my dad about it, because it became something that I actually couldn't hide, because I would be at like my dad's house and I would be like going into an OCD spiral and people would notice.
When you say an OCD spiral, can you describe that for us?
Yeah, so for me, it's not like I don't have any compulsion to like wash my hands or tap things or do any like repetitive patterns like that. For me, it's like I'll get a thought in my head, and it will be like, so for example, when I got my autoimmune disease, it was like, yeah, you've got AIDS. And a person that doesn't have OCD would be, no, like I can rationalize this. This is the reasons why you don't, blah, 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 blah. And although I can hear the rational voice, the irrational thoughts completely take over, to the point where there's no, like, I just cannot rationalize anything. Even small things, like I couldn't have baths for a long period of time when I was a kid, because I was having intrusive thoughts about the shark, like a shark coming up the plug hole. But it's like more than normal fears. It's like the inability to rationalize silly things, basically. Everyone gets intrusive thoughts. I think everyone gets like thoughts that just come into their head and they can't get over it. But it's, for me, it's like I cannot, once I get those thoughts, that's it. And it spirals down, and then more thoughts come in, and it's sort of like that, I guess.
How are things now? I mean, are you getting support with those struggles? And I guess equally, Emma, where are you both now? Because you've described a lot of the challenges growing up of not knowing, and then post-diagnosis, has life got easier for both of you, and how?
So for me, unfortunately, I've not really ever received proper help for my OCD, because there's a 3-year wait list for CBT therapy on the NHS. Gosh. But luckily, just like a few weeks ago, my dad managed to put me on his work healthcare. So I'm finally at the stage where I've got my referral and I'm going to like get the proper help that I've sort of needed since I was a child.
Yay. Thank goodness. Gosh.
So that's positive. Yay.
And Emma, where are you at now in your autistic self?
Because I'm someone who has got, sadly, a lot of trauma that happened as a result of just not having a proper diagnosis early enough, I feel anyway, I think that trauma still very much affects me today. And dealing with that as an autistic person is very, very difficult, because actually, quite similarly to what Sophie's just described, it is a spiral of anxiety and thoughts I can't control. But I think, I mean, I don't receive any professional help anymore, mostly because I don't trust I really don't trust people to know how to help me. So it would take a lot for me to go and get help for things that I find difficult with my autism, for example. But you know, I think I'm lucky in the sense that I've got a partner that's really understanding of everything that I go through daily, and I've got a family that you know, supports me in the best way that they can. So yeah, I mean, I'd love to be able to be like, yeah, you know, I have loads of health and I feel great all the time, but that wouldn't be honest. Like, it's the honest truth is that I struggle every single day with lots of different things, and I, you know, that is just reality for me. So yeah.
Are those struggles largely because of lack of understanding?
You know, it's kind of like, I hate to bring it up, but it is like the whole thing where people are, oh, well, this country isn't racist at all. It feels like that for me. People are so quick to be like, oh, but I'm not judgmental. I'm really understanding. Like, my brother's sister's boyfriend's partner's cousin has autism, so I know all about it. And it's like, you could not even begin to imagine the stuff that happens for me. And I wouldn't pretend to understand what goes on for you. And I guess, like, my fear is that people think that they do get it. Then I'll do something that's very typically autistic and people are like, do you know what I mean? And like, they back off really quickly. So for me, it's like, I'm constantly masking. I'm constantly trying to be like, you know, if I'm in a shop and someone speaks to me, like, when you have a baby, I'm sure that everyone, well, you guys can relate. People come up to you and they're like, oh, what a gorgeous baby. And they want to touch the baby and they want to like do like crazy mad gestures, and I'm like there, like trying to work out what they're doing. If they're, you know, if they're, are they talking to me? Like, are they talking to the baby? Like, can I hold eye contact with them? Like, should I look down? Like, it's really hard to explain, but that's the kind of thing that I feel makes me really anxious, and people just don't understand, don't get, because this, like, because our society is so ableist. And I think, interesting, we always assume that everyone, unless it's a physical disability that you can see, that everyone's normal, everyone's neurotypical.
Yeah. And that's, it's the assumptions. Yeah.
Yeah. And that's what I think is really quite a damaging thing. So yeah.
Mm. Yeah. And that's 100%. The gap, basically, isn't it? It's the gap is a gap in understanding, empathy, kind of knowing how the world looks from other people's perspectives. I don't know, did you happen to see the Inside Out Autistic Minds? It's basically Chris Packham, who is autistic himself, and I think that was really what was great about it as well, was that he was presenting a show not as like an outsider going, let's go and understand a totally different experience to my own, but as somebody who empathized and understood.
Because it's crazy how easily people will understand if they actually listen and are, and it's explained to them properly.
Yeah.
But yeah.
And I think that's it. Bridging the gap. It's not just about redesigning everything. It's about listening. Like, you can only understand if you listen. And I feel like, yeah, we need to listen to everybody more.
And being exposed to as much diversity as possible. I think it's so easy to talk about it, which we're doing, but to actually see it is so different. And I think we need as much exposure as possible.
I think it's bad for everybody. Everybody is richer for a more diverse and interesting world. What advice would you give to me as a mom who has one daughter who kind of commands a lot of attention because of behavior, and also because she has lots of medical and like speech therapy, physiotherapy type appointments, and then my other daughter who just kind of gets on with it? It's hard sometimes when one child is very,
oh my gosh, it must be so hard. Like, and I don't blame my mum and dad at all. Like, it's not their fault. And also because of my OCD, I was like purposely not speaking about it. Right. Like, it was because I didn't want them to, like, I was anxious about what would happen if I did. Like, it was a whole thing. But I think the difference between like you guys and where my parents were at when they were dealing with everything is that they knew like the word neurodiversity wasn't really a word that I knew. I don't, yeah. I think I probably only knew that word when I was about 16, 17, and I think you just have to, like, I don't know, I guess it's just like making time for everyone and making everyone's experiences valid and what everyone's feeling valid. And it is really hard growing up with a sibling that maybe commands more attention or more or needs more help or whatever, and it's really difficult. But just because someone needs more help than me, I think it's just the reassurance of that, like, they are still a valid human even if they are not struggling with things.
Yeah, valuing everybody equally is key, yeah. I guess to all of this, the world needs to do more of that as well.
You have to have confidence in the fact that just by asking questions like, what do I do as a mum who has one child that's like this and one child like that, you're probably already doing so much more than you give yourself credit for and you realize, because I don't think it's a natural state when you've got one child that has very overt needs to consider the other child when you're presented with something that is so obvious and so taking up space and time, you're of course going to be like, you know, hyper focus on getting solutions there. But just by having these conversations and by being in the groups that you guys are in and acknowledging it is huge. Just the acknowledgement that there could be this dynamic where this other child needs. I think a lot of my OCD manifested in the exact same way that Sophie's did. And the reason it didn't go diagnosed for so long was in a really similar way. Family dynamics sort of meant that I very easily kept what was going on with me very covert. And what happened with my family, because my parents weren't aware of the potential for me to have any underlying issues either, was that I shouldering a lot of the burden of other things that were going on. And I think just if I had just one little bit of advice to parents that might be going through something similar, is just trying to identify the difference between the sibling becoming part of the support network versus becoming like a third parent in the situation. You know, I think that's the big difference.
That's a really big challenge as well, because I am like aware of that, but it still happens at times. You know, it's like my older daughter does perform kind of some
duties.
Like a carer role some of the time, and it's hard to draw a line of what an older sibling would be asked to do ordinarily, because older siblings do get asked to tie their younger siblings' shoelaces or whatever it might be, versus what's kind of out of the ordinary and then becomes, like you say, shouldering a kind of burden of, I am responsible for caring for this child and supporting this child with their needs.
It's so challenging because the sibling that feels that they are responsible, like you said, will just naturally fall into that. So it's like an unlearning thing. It's not like there's very little I think anyone can do to stop them feeling that way, because I think most siblings will naturally feel that way. But then I think it's probably just awareness from the parents to identify when it's happening and try and like let them know that it's not their responsibility, you know. But yeah, as I said, I think you probably are doing so much more than you even realize. So don't feel too
But I think, you know, it's on everybody to talk about these things with their children, regardless of whether they have a child that's neurodiverse or not. I think it's on us as parents to teach our children to be understanding and empathetic, and when they see difference, not assume it means deficit, but be curious, and that's okay, and that's great. So that leads us nicely into what you guys are doing now, the three of you, putting on this play, Just Be Normal, that you wrote, Sophie. And before we talk a little more about that, I think we're going to be treated to a little extract, a monologue from the play. Is that right? So,
okay.
Autism. A developmental disorder of variable severity that is characterized by difficulty in social interaction and communication, by restrictive or repetitive thoughts and patterns of behavior. Life categorized into boxes of different levels of misbehavior. She felt like a complete failure since the age of 13, since she was barely a teenager when toddler-like tantrums turned to tactless people turning their backs on the talentless teen. instead of treating her kindly, treating her as something to be tolerated. Was I different? No. I was aggravated and so frustrated as I slowly donated my life to a world that rotated around her. I mean, for fuck's sake, she was older than me. Why couldn't she follow things how they're supposed to be? Go to school, be carefree, I don't know, after, maybe get a degree? My parents would agree, and now we all look back and feel, well, shit. And guilty. She brought her knees up to her chest and couldn't even try and do her best because it was never enough and she was done. Looking back to around 2001 when her blank canvas wasn't branded by a doctor's diagnosis because it didn't exist. Autism in girls didn't exist. I mean, 2001. We had the technology to have our first iPods, to clone stormtroopers, no Kubrick supercomputers, just a generation of men in white coats deeming girls as difficult. Was it a gift that she wasn't restricted to disability? Let's wait and see. Relationships wrecked, I'm sorry, rambling rackets of rigmarole, but what is the moral of this story? What if you have to be yourself, but you don't know what that is yet because the laboratory only just put you in this category and everything is too loud, too hard, too much, but also mandatory, like school? Since aged 5. Some were kind, but most were so fucking blind to the signs, she screamed. Now she's 17 and she's looking back on her life and everyone has just been so mean, to put it simply. She self-isolates. No chance for a clean slate and she's stuck. She's starting to become angry, like, I'm sorry, what the actual fuck? Sorry, Emma, it's inappropriate for you to speak to teachers like that. She doesn't care. I think you're a twat. Well, as a matter of fact, with a mouth like that, it would be a miracle if you made it further than becoming a teen mother. After that, she began to stop, not bother. She didn't feel stronger. Life began to look longer and longer. The monsters, however, she held did become stronger. And right there, she was conquered by loneliness. Just take a deep breath. Today, 1 in 54 people are autistic and they don't need a cure. But to be honest, they need more so they can live life as more than just a chore and not be at constant war with their own mind. Around 700,000 people are on the spectrum, but not one case the same. Life without structure or frame. This is something we need to change so someone like Emma can be on more than just council wage and exchange her feeling strange and out of place for something better. So she can fight and not be like the others who had to give up and say goodnight. When all she really needs is for someone to help her. To help her feel all right.
Woo! Wow. That was great.
Oh my God, I'm so excited to see this play.
That's really great. Thank you. Tell us why you rewrote the play and what you guys are all hoping to achieve by putting this on.
So we were having a conversation over lockdown. Emma was just telling me all about, like, we were just going over like memories and recapping what has been going on. And then I sort of just had like an afterthought of like, what? Like, how were you just left to not be in school? There's so many things that have happened that I don't know how they've happened, but they have, and it's too late to change them. But it was kind of like seeking justice, I guess. This is why I started writing it. And then it just kind of, yeah, and then Connor obviously helped me develop it, and it's kind of gone onto this whole thing now. So yeah.
Amazing. Amazing.
Has it been a tonic, almost a therapeutic for you both, for you, Sophie, to have written it, but also to have gone through performing it together?
I think it has been definitely therapeutic to write it. I think the first time we performed it, we didn't come into any arguments or any issues, and it was really nice. And then the second time, there's been sort of more conversation between the three of us, and it's been more difficult this time emotionally, I think, than it was last time for whatever reason. But it's good because every conversation that we're having is sort of adding more things into the play that need to be spoken about. And it's the whole idea of like, we're all still learning about this, like this is all still really new to all of us, even if it's like the lived experience of our lives.
Emma, did you learn, Sophie, like more about Emma's journey and her experiences while you were writing?
I don't know why, but I don't think it really hit me how bad it was that she just was left to leave school at that age until I was older, and I've been through school and I've done my GCSEs and I've done my A-levels, and I know that Emma sort of left school with not very many GCSEs. Yeah, it was shocking. It's awful. It's not on. It's really bad.
Gosh. And Emma, was it kind of like a therapy session for you? That's how I would imagine it was.
the lockdown I personally loved, because it just allowed me to like exist in this way that I've always wanted to. And obviously my partner couldn't go into work. It was amazing. And I felt like it really gave Sophie time to write this, and we could have proper conversations about stuff that had gone on, which like maybe before the lockdown, like it wasn't even a case of, oh, Sophie just was busy and didn't ask me, or I was busy and I didn't respond or whatever. It was just that there wasn't that time to breathe and really like reflect back on all this awful but also really funny and like hilarious things that had happened to the both of us growing up. But I think that in itself was a therapy session. I think like the first time round, as Sophie said, it was slightly easier, just in the sense that, yeah, we didn't run into, oh, hold on a minute, like actually I don't like that or whatever. I think there's been lots of things that I've had to sit back and actually really listen to and go away and reflect on myself and think, actually, like, this isn't all about you, like, shock horror, like, you know.
Oh no,
someone else could also be experiencing something, you know, on the same level that has nothing to do with you, and you should go away and actually think about that. And I think Sophie will agree that there's lots more stuff about her own journey with neurodiversity, and I think that's taken me a while to come to terms with. Like, I'm sure my diagnosis took her a while to kind of understand properly, and I have tried hard now this time to, like I say, understand better about lots of different neurodiversities and what that can mean to other people, because as we've all said many times, this process should be the beginning of learning about, you know, all sorts of different things that people go through daily. So yeah, I think also it is difficult. I mean, it's difficult for me to hear Sophie say that monologue, because lots of that is true and that did happen, and that's quite a heartbreaking thing now as an adult to look back on, you know, on that. I find that quite difficult to swallow. Obviously I'm just lucky that Sophie can do it in a way that how I'd like my story to be told. So that's, you know, there's lots of different aspects, you know, that come into it.
And how have like friends and family reacted?
There was one friend that both me and Sophie have, and I think he was quite taken aback. But I think what was quite interesting is a lot of my old teachers came, but I think they were almost sickly sweet after the fact that they had realized all this stuff was going on and maybe how badly I was treated by teachers. So for me, that felt like Sophie had given me this way to be like, first of all, fuck you, and second of all, you should be here, because actually you are the type of people that we want here being confronted with your shitty behavior, and hopefully you can take something from this and learn from it, and never make the same mistake that you made with me again. That's how I felt.
I just love the fact that it was a play all about Emma, like the sort of shitty people that kicked Emma out of school and whatever, and she came back and did it on that stage at the school. So I was just like, that's great.
I love that.
I mean, I have to say, just before I'm horrible about everyone I went to school with, there were teachers there that I'll give an honourable mention to for me, who were really, really nice to me and did genuinely want me to succeed. So it was nice to have them there, because it was like I finally, in all of school, I never did well in anything, socially, academically. I was never stupid. At that moment, I just couldn't. I didn't have any extra Emma to give to anything, like hobbies, studying, anything. So it was nice for me to finally turn around to the people who did say, come on, if you apply yourself, you could do this, this, and this, to say, well, look, with Connor's help, with the team, with Akimbo, with Sophie, I have applied myself, and here you go. Like, this is, you know, I've finally done something.
Sophie, what about family members and your friends? How did they react to the play?
I was so scared for people to see this, especially because when we first did it, identifying as someone with OCD was very, very, very new and very, very raw. And I was like, oh my God, all of these people who never knew anything about me or what I was going through are just suddenly going to find out pretty much everything. So I was really, really scared. But I think like the support that both like our dad and and our mum have given us, because it must be difficult in the, you'll see in the play when you see it, but like as a parent, it's got to be difficult to watch your two children doing a play about that they messed up and that they didn't do things in the right way. But I think the response that we've got from them isn't that like, oh, like, why did you write that? It was more like, what can we now do differently to be better?
That's which brilliant.
That everyone wanted to be better afterwards. So yeah. that's good.
Because every parent fucks up their kids. That's the, you know, as the poem goes. But but not every parent has to see it put on in a play for them to see exactly how they fucked up their kids. But maybe every parent should.
I think every parent should.
There'd be a whole industry in there. And Connor, what brought you to the play and wanting to get behind this project, and what do you hope it'll lead to or achieve?
I think it was just something I could relate to sort of growing up with particular family dynamics, was this idea that you've got one sibling that needs all the attention very immediately and another sibling who also needs a lot of attention but potentially less immediately, and how that then manifests into a very immediate need for attention later down the line because there's been like this level of suppression. And just from a sort of theatrical point of view, as a sort of dramatic narrative arc, it just felt like it really made sense and it was perfect. So Sophie went away and injected all of her very recent experience as someone who lives with OCD into it. And then when I read that draft, I was like, this has to be put on. It's fantastic. We have to go and put this on somewhere. At the same time, I was developing this production company called Akimbo, and our whole sort of shtick was to see more projects like this out there. As we've sort of been talking about, bridge that gap between people wanting to know more and actually getting access to good representation. But also people just feeling like they're being accurately represented as well, accurately and positively represented.
That's the most important thing, I think.
Like, something's had a profound effect on them. The education comes anyway.
Naturally,
exactly. And can often linger for longer as well, if there's that lasting effect. So it was like, okay, we know what we need to do now. We've ticked the education box. Now we need to really punch the audience in the gut with some more. Yeah, there's a ton of layers to it.
That sounds amazing. I'm really looking forward to seeing
honestly,
it.
Honestly, me too.
You know, that got big expectations. Yeah,
no pressure at all.
I'm sure it's going to live up to that.
Honestly.
Like, the only way we'd get a realistic representation of what these guys' lived experiences is if we have the rough with the smooth and the heavy with the light and the dark with the, you know, the comedy. So, you know, they do a great job of staging some of the more ridiculous, hilarious things they went through as well. And
that's brilliant.
Yeah, hopefully that sort of contrast is what will have the sort of the impact that we're looking for.
I'm a big believer in kind of laughing through
the
grittiest and the darkest moments in your life.
So many funny things happen as well. Exactly. I feel like so much funny stuff happens.
Obviously, aside from completely changing the world and the way that the world understands and embraces neurodiversity, is this kind of the start of something then, Connor, for Akimbo, in terms of, you said this is kind of exactly what you wanted to take on in terms of a project that was more inclusive and told these kind of stories. Is the plan to do more of these?
Yeah, I mean, absolutely. We're a really small team and we all have day jobs. So this is kind of like we all come from this industry, but as I think we're probably all aware of, sadly, these kinds of projects manifest themselves in sort of commercial environments more as tick box exercises than they do to enact meaningful change. So we're trying to make this kind of project profitable so that we can just do this, but meanwhile we're also sort of in and around the full spectrum of the creative industry. But what's been wonderful is that we've had so much more engagement with people far and wide this second time around, including, you know, you guys, bloggers and influencers and people like that who share the lived experience, sort of wanting to engage with us on it. And I'm just hoping the more the word can be spread, the more chance this project has of having a wider spread impact.
One, are your performances going to be a bit more accessible mm-hmm. in terms of the environment that they're in? And then also, how do we make, or how do you as someone in the industry make steps towards a more accessible experience yeah. for people, not just kind of what they're watching, but the environment itself?
Yeah, it's such a huge undertaking, to be honest, because by its very nature, theatre isn't an accessible art form for anyone. You know, a lot of old school institutions are incredibly biased to a certain type of people that should be working in them and enjoying those spaces. That includes disabled communities and neurodivergent communities. And the theatres and institutions that seem to have all the resources and money at their disposal find it hard to make these spaces accessible. So when you ask a little old indie production company, you know, how best to do it for a fringe festival, it's like, well, the answer is near on impossible. But
yeah,
we are constantly having conversations between us about how we can achieve it on the budget we have and with the resources and time we have. I think it starts with the play itself. You know, it's no good speaking a gospel without the people that actually are affected by it in the room to engage with it and share their experiences as well. It just doesn't work. So the dynamic there is like, how do we show a difficult neurodiverse experience on stage for people who wouldn't understand what that's like because they don't live with it, whilst not making it so much so that it actually becomes uncomfortable for people who do live through it? So we've been trying to, this isn't something that we've come up with. This has happened in really incredible indie production companies way before us, but we're trying to navigate the idea of a relaxed performance. So it just means that you can come and enjoy the show. It's not stuffy duffy old school theatre rules where you have to sit still. You can't, you know, you can't move, you can't get up and leave if things get overwhelming. You know, everybody has free rein to come and go as they need to in the theatre. It's kind of like a just be considerate mantra. It's like, if you had to put it in one sentence, it's like, just be considerate. We're trying to caption every performance we have. We're also working towards an audio described performance. So what that means is people can access an audio file on their phone through their headphones if they are visually impaired, so that they get my voice, unfortunately, describing the action whilst they're hearing the dialogue. So
sounds great.
Yeah, we're just trying. And we're not going to get it right ultimately, and we know we're not going to get it completely right. And we just need to, at this stage, celebrate the little victories that we can accomplish. But we know that it's not something we're going to get right overnight.
And I think that's true in general, mm-hmm. right? So I think, like, in bridging this gap, because that's the term we've used, it's like, actually one of the ways that we bridge the gap is also, don't be afraid to get things wrong, mm-hmm. like learn from them. And I know we've talked about it before, but sometimes I think these things become so polarizing and people get so angry, and it's okay to get angry, but just make sure we're getting angry at the right people and the right things, not at people who are trying and who are listening and want to learn and do better.
Yeah,
it's like, yeah, yeah.
And I think especially now with like cancel culture and like everything that's going on with that, it's so dangerous because there's so many people like that will just cancel people for saying something that they don't know isn't right, or they don't know isn't. And although it's annoying that they don't know, because we do know, but it's like, if they're then willing to listen and learn and change that, then cancelling them is just cancelling another person who's actually an ally and actually willing to listen. And
I think it's quite dangerous. And the only way that you can learn is by making mistakes. Like, nobody's perfect.
It's what's difficult at the minute is like, how do we, because right now a lot of disabled and neurodiverse people do not feel safe in theatre spaces for the right, you know, for rightly so, because they're not built for them, like most environments that, you know,
yeah,
the typical world, ableist world we live in. But it's like, how do we get the word out that we're doing these types of performances and they're very welcome there, without as well, you know, kind of using our performances as you know, using those people as guinea pigs for, you know, it's very difficult to navigate, because you want to make them feel safe and welcome, with the caveat that it's like, it's our first time doing accessible performances too, so I'm really sorry if we get it wrong. And ultimately, we as small organizations and units, and it's the same for you guys with your parents' help group, you know, we shouldn't be shouldering the burden of trying to fix the world's problems. You know, we, like, you guys should have direct access to the right specialists and medical care and therapy care to get the solutions you need with your lived experience, trying to put a show together on a shoestring whilst making it accessible to everybody as well. You know, my point is that the society we have built ourselves, as even whether you're neurotypical or not, does not serve anybody. No. It doesn't serve anybody. And I don't need to tell you this as four women, you know, because you have all, you know, and this is the other point that I have to say, is that I come to this conversation with shitloads of privilege, absolute truckloads of it. You guys come to the conversation with varying degrees of privilege too. You know, we're four white people, we're five white people. You know, we can't speak on this conversation from a heritage and race perspective, but it all counts. This conversation any conversation like this is so intersectional, you know, and the oppressive systems that aren't working for us aren't working for people that don't look like us too. And it's only by us all coming together and sharing the experiences that we can dismantle oppressive systems.
15 to 20% of the world have display some neurodivergence.
Mm.
That's more people in the world than have blue eyes or red hair or whatever.
That's what I was going to say, is that what gripes me is when people who, you know, claim to be completely neurotypical or completely the other side of whoever the oppressed is, whether they're sort of direct oppressors or just sort of part of that system, is they're kind of people who are scared of like a change in the other direction, like they're going to lose a part of their identity or they're going to lose some privilege that they have. And it's like, it's not working for you either, mate. Like, you know, it's who are you protecting? What are you trying to uphold here? Because what the biggest suicide rates are in white men, you know. So it's what are white blokes doing upholding a system that's killing them,
not working for them?
Yeah. You know, it's like it's not working for them either. And that's what, and it's down to education. It's going to take everybody to change it.
Yeah.
So I just wanted to jump in and say quickly as well, I don't know if this is following on from your point or not, but I do feel too that there needs to stop being this like idea that it's my responsibility or Sophie's responsibility or Connor's responsibility or both of your responsibilities to educate you about something that you can go away and research yourself. Now, I take that there isn't a lot of information about girls with autism, that's slightly different, but you know, there's enough out there that you can go and educate yourself to a degree. I shouldn't have to be standing up and being like, now this is what I'm going through, this is what you need to be careful. But no, you need to go and take that responsibility and learn. You know, I am sick of people saying as well that there isn't enough out there, because whilst that's true, if you look for it and if you're genuinely like committed to making things better for everyone, not just neurodiverse people but everyone, you can do that. It's like, it does start in school and introducing that more and not being so afraid of the abnormal normal, if that makes sense, because I do think it comes from people being like, if you see someone with a physical disability, for example, people on the tube, people are automatically like, oh well, I'll stay away and I won't look at them and I'll be, you know, I'll put my head down. It's like, fucking hell, like, get a grip. But do you know what I mean? Like, this is our issue. Why are we not,
you know, doing more ourselves? Why does it take this like push, this push? And I know that the answer will be, well, that's just the society that we live in, but it's like, yeah, so let's all do something about that then. You know, I feel a lot of pressure that a lot of the time, I'm sure that like my sister Sophie will say, and Connor, that I'm constantly like, oh God, like I don't want to upset, you know, people in the autistic community. I don't want to upset people in the neurotypical community. I'm constantly thinking, but like, it gets to a point where it's just everyone's different, and like we all need to just come together and find some common ground that works for everyone, and it just isn't that difficult. That is the point. I really hope that in doing this, like, we can all get better at that. I think it is just tiring. I do just want people to realize that autism and other neurodiversities don't have to look how they've previously been presented to look. And yeah, it's not the responsibility of the people that have these neurodiversities or physical disabilities or whatever that looks like to pay you. That's your responsibility.
Everybody has a responsibility to learn and do better, I think is what you're saying. Yeah. And
yeah,
we'll get there, guys.
But look at us all now. We're all trying to make people learn, and we're all learning off each other. And it's so nice to hear, like, that for like my inner child or whatever, it's so nice to hear that there's like all of you guys getting together and wanting to learn, not just trying to get your child to fit into these boxes, but actually like being like, yeah, this is it. And this is, I just think it's really good.
Likewise, I'm honestly so that you guys are doing this. I mean, I like, God, Sophie, I really want my children to see this.
Exactly.
Yeah, I think it's really important to say as well, because a lot of the conversation around, well, you know, if we make it a more neurodivergent world, like, you know, aren't we just going to have people that can't really fit into society, you know, how things have to be? And it's like, the reason why it feels very us and them right now is because the world and environment we've built for ourselves unable to unlock the brilliance that comes from people who are disabled and neurodivergent. And that's not me saying like that there's the whole autistic genius trope, you know, which autistic people don't need to be geniuses to be accepted in society and be given job opportunities and start families at all. But what is true is that often autistic people, neurodivergent people and disabled people who have very different lived experience than, you know, quote unquote, able-bodied people, is that they see the world we live in a very, very different way. And that can often be harnessed to make some really powerful and wonderful change. That's what I'd say to anybody that's like, but what does the world look like that can cater for everybody? It's like, well, you better. a lot better. And maybe, you know, there's a place in world leadership for people that are neurodivergent and disabled. Not maybe, I mean, there is. They're fucking yeah. It. Absolutely, just, there is
the richness of there's so much value in all. I see that, like, my younger daughter, she has a different set of skills and things that are wonderful about her that don't neatly fit into the bracket of what society or certainly school expect of an eight-year-old kid. She makes me see the world differently, like the things that she notices, the way that she behaves when she hears music that she likes, or, you know, these things that I don't see in neurotypical, I hate using that term, but neurotypical kids. Yeah. I think they're beautiful and actually should be valued for just bringing something different to the party.
Yeah,
for sure. Definitely. Yeah, I mean, that as a baseline is true. And I think that why it's been really important for us to put this play on and have the conversation we're having in an environment like theatre is because there's no one way to do theatre. There's myriad ways to do theatre, to put on, you know, a performing art. But strong and impactful theatre, in whatever way it manifests, can have a resounding effect on people. You know, that's true for any good theatre. So what irks me is that of all environments out there should be an environment where we're welcoming people that don't fit into society's rigid block.
Especially because stuff like Atypical, the TV program, I don't know if people have seen that, and we use people who like for entertainment and don't represent them right.
And so I think bringing those sorts of people with those perspectives and ways of seeing the world into a space where you're like, we have the ability in this space to change worldviews, to change perspectives, to make people see things differently. It should be the number one go-to place for, you know, people, neurodivergent and disabled people should see opportunities in those spaces aplenty. They shouldn't be feeling like they don't belong in them or they're not welcome to them. So that, I think that's my hope with how many other thousands of children out there that could unlock.
I think if people are going to take away anything of it, like we're at the starting point of change, and it's going to take a long time, but we are at least acknowledging it now.
That is beautiful. Thank you. A perfect description of what you guys are trying to do. And I applaud you from afar.
Thank you. Thank you so much. Yeah, that's brilliant. And I, you know, can't wait to see the play. I can't wait to see what you guys do next or where this play might end up or go after this runs. It's really exciting, guys. And I love everything that you're doing.
Definitely. Thank you so, so, so much for your time. It's been wonderful chatting to you.
Before we finish this, do you have a fucking normal that you want to share?
Connor.
So my fucking normal is finally getting to a place where I can laugh at my intrusive thoughts. My fucking normal is I've now got to a place where I can just laugh at that shit because it's ridiculous. And I think a lot of what they teach you in CBT and sort of coping mechanisms for that type of OCD is just seeing the funny side.
So my fucking normal is pretending to be on the phone to someone so that people do not come up to me or my daughter in public, so I can avoid social interaction at all costs.
My fucking normal is literally damaging my ears because I have to listen to music so loud to stop the thoughts sometimes.
Love it.
So, yeah.
Oh, amazing. And oh, thank you.
Thank
guys.
You. We really look forward to seeing the play and hopefully seeing you guys. Yeah, after maybe a drink afterwards. And yeah. Thank you so much for listening to the Fucking Normal podcast. We love making this podcast.
Yes, we do.
We are part of a much bigger team, almost exclusively all parents of disabled children. And our goal is to reach as many people as possible and create a community of support for parents and carers who share our experiences.
So, if you've liked what you've heard, please like and subscribe so that we can reach out to more people. You can find more information on this and other episodes at fuckingnormalpodcast.com. That's fkingnormalpodcast.com. You can join us on Facebook and on Instagram at fuckingnormal_podcast. That's fkingnormal_podcast. You can get all the links and more information in the show notes below.
So thank you so much for listening all the way to the end. We'll see you next time.
Bye.
Wake me up.